So the goal of tonight's shiur, the goal of tonight's lecture, is to explore the three Jewish pre-state military units in Eretz Yisrael. We just said the Kelmole, to mark and to reflect upon those who gave their lives for Medinat Yisrael. And sometimes we think of those who gave their lives for Medinat Yisrael only after the state was created, or from the Melchemet Yom HaShichrur, from the War of Independence and onward. This evening, I want to focus on the three defensive military units in Eretz Yisrael and pre-state of Israel: the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Lehi, the difference between them, and how religious Jews viewed each of these units. We will begin our discussion with the second Aliyah, which took place between 1904 and 1914. As Jewish settlements began to pop up throughout Eretz Yisrael, Arab marauders attacked these settlements. In 1907, a small group of Jewish immigrants formed a Jewish organization called Bar Giora to protect the settlements for an annual fee. Eventually, it was converted into an organization called HaShomer in 1909, and they guarded Jewish settlements until the British Mandate of Palestine came into being in 1920. Remember, at the start of World War I, Eretz Yisrael was part of the Ottoman Empire. In 1915, Joseph Trumpeldor, I do have a picture of him here, just very briefly. This is Joseph Trumpeldor on the right. So he recruited volunteers from among the Jews in Egypt to volunteer for the British Army, and they formed the Zion Mule Corps, a volunteer transport organization for the army, and it served for some time in the war and then disbanded in the year of 1916. In 1917, a Jewish battalion for the British Army was formed, and more than 1,000 Jews enlisted, and they engaged the Ottomans north of Jerusalem in 1918, and importantly, they received military training. Now, they disbanded after World War I, but now Palestine was part of the British Mandate. And the Jews initially thought that the British would protect them. However, after the Arab riots against the Jews in 1920, the Jews realized that they needed to create a nationwide underground defense organization. And the picture on the left, Zev Jabotinsky, his Russian name was Vladimir Jabotinsky. So Vladimir Jabotinsky was a right-wing Zionist activist who founded the Revisionist Movement. The Revisionist Movement was a forerunner to Herut, which eventually merged with other right-wing parties to form what we know today as the Likud Party. After the Arab riots, Jabotinsky openly trained Jews in warfare and the use of small arms. He was arrested and given a 15-year prison term until he was pardoned 3 months later. The Jews then believed they could not rely on the British administration to protect them. So they founded the Haganah as an underground movement. The Haganah took responsibility for the defense of the entire Yishuv, the entire Jewish settlement. At first, they were poorly organized. But after the Arab riots in 1929, the Haganah became a much larger organization, encompassing nearly all the youth and the adults in the Jewish settlements, as well as thousands from the cities. Both conscription and weapons increased as they became a capable paramilitary organization. Now, the Zionist Congress was divided over the Haganah because some felt that a military organization would antagonize the British and would slow down the process for statehood, and they should only work diplomatically but not militarily to achieve statehood. At the same time, the Histadrut, which was the forerunner for the Labor Party, and which was headed by David Ben-Gurion, eventually the first Prime Minister of Israel, the Histadrut oversaw the Haganah and helped acquire weapons illegally for the Haganah. That being said, in 1936, the Haganah actually cooperated to protect British interests and to quell the Arab rebellion. And at that time, they numbered 10,000 mobilized men and 40,000 reservists. Now, the British administration did not officially recognize the Haganah, but they cooperated with it. And they provided Colonel Ord Wingate to help train the Haganah. And he was a Christian Zionist. He was a very firm Christian Jew who believed in the Zionist cause. And he was actually very successful in training the Haganah in what was called active defense, like using ambushes and patrols, not just sitting back and waiting for the enemy to attack. But, and he was a significant figure in strengthening the Haganah. So it's here that we begin our discussion of the Irgun. The Irgun was a breakaway movement from the Haganah. After the Arab riots of 1929, there was a feeling by some that the Haganah was too passive and was not adequately defending Jewish interests in the region. And they were opposed to the Haganah's policy of Havlaga. Havlaga means restraint. In 1931, a new underground movement was formed under the leadership of Avraham Tehomi and other senior members of the Haganah. This new movement was called Irgun Tzivai Le'umi, the National Military Organization, in order to emphasize its active nature. Haganah means what? Defense. Irgun Tzivai, Tzivai means military. We are active. Or it was Etzel for short, or Irgun for short. Some refer to Etzel, and some refer to it as Irgun. And this movement was supported by Jabotinsky. Now, if you look on the source sheet, hold on one second. If you look on the source sheet, so you see in the bottom left-hand corner, this was the emblem for Etzel. This has a map. And if you notice, first of all, the map has both Palestine and Transjordan, which the Irgun claimed in its entirety for a future Jewish state. You know, when we talk about the Greater Israel, we talk about, the West Bank, Yehuda and Shomron as being the Greater Israel. For Etzel, the Greater Israel was much more than that. It was even Transjordan. Additionally, if you notice in this, it has a picture of a gun to focus on its active state. And Rak Kach, only this, is written below. This is how we must establish a Jewish state, like this, through force. This was the emblem of the Irgun, or some want to call it Etzel. Now, their philosophy was not only defense, but taking the war to the enemy if necessary. And an open rift was created between Haganah and the Irgun. During the Arab revolt of 1936 to 1939, the Arabs protested Jewish immigration to Palestine, and they believed that by rioting, they could end this. The Arabs ambushed main roads, they bombed roads and settlements, and they destroyed Jewish property. In the beginning, both Haganah and the Irgun did not respond to these attacks. And Irgun even considered joining Haganah. Tehomi was quoted as saying, "We stand before great events, a Jewish state and a Jewish army. There is a need for a single military force." And in fact, a referendum was held among Irgun members regarding its continued independent existence. And the Irgun split after the referendum. Half the membership, approximately 1,500 to 2,000, returned to the Haganah, which was under the Jewish agency leadership, and half remained. And those who remained ended the policy of restraint. The policy of restraint was to gain support of the British for a Jewish armed force and fear that Jewish immigration would stop if there was a Jewish-Arab civil war. The downside of the policy of Havlagah of restraint is that it encourages Arabs to continue attacking without any consequences. Irgun now was under the leadership of David Raziel, an Orthodox Jew. And by the way, he made Shmirat Shabbat as part of the Irgun doctrine. With very few exceptions, with David Raziel in charge, the Irgun never attacked on Shabbat. But they did attack when it was not Shabbat. They rejected the policy of Havlagah of restraint. The official end of Havlagah was November 14th, 1937. Following an increase in the number of attacks armed at Jews, including the killing of five kibbutz members near Kiryat Anavim, the Irgun undertook a series of attacks in various places in Jerusalem, killing five Arabs. And operations were also undertaken in Haifa and Herzliya. This date, November 14th, 1937, was known as Black Sunday, when operations resulted in the death of 10 Arabs. In response, the British arrested suspected members of the Irgun, and in fear of the British threat of the death sentence for anyone found carrying a weapon, all operations of the Irgun were suspended for 8 months. However, in April 1938, in response to the killing of six Jews, members of the Irgun ambushed an Arab bus, but it was a failed ambush with no casualties. The grenade didn't even detonate. Three were caught, and one, Shlomo ben Yosef, was sentenced to death, and he was executed. After this execution, the Irgun resumed armed offensive operations until the end of the Arab Revolt in 1939. At the same time, the Irgun also started illegal immigration of 20,000 Jews to Eretz Yisrael. Meanwhile, on May 23rd, 1939, the British government adopted what's called, what many of us know on the right-hand side here, it's called the White Paper. This is the Palestine Statement of Policy proposed by the, I can't even read it now, the state for the, by command of His Majesty, dated May 1939. This is the cover. This is the, and this is the, in this document, what many of us know as the White Paper. It limited Jewish immigration in Palestine to 75,000 over 5 years, and further immigration was to be determined by the Arab majority, and restrictions were put on the rights of Jews to buy land from Arabs. And it also rejected the idea of partitioning Palestine into separate Jewish and Arab states. In effect, this rolled back the clock from the Balfour Declaration of 1917. Now, once this happened, the Irgun began attacking not the Arabs, but the Irgun began attacking the British. They sabotaged strategic infrastructure such as electricity facilities, radio, and telephone lines. And the British increased their efforts to stop the Irgun. And on August 31st, 1939, they arrested members meeting in the Irgun headquarters. Of course, what happened the very next day? On the very next day, World War II broke out. Then the question was, whom would the Irgun support, the British or the Germans? In 1940, the Irgun again stopped its operations and joined Ben-Gurion, who famously said, quote, "We will fight the White Paper as if there is no war, and fight the war as if there is no White Paper." Now, many members of the Irgun disagreed with this policy. And on July 17th, 1940, a new organization, a second breakaway, so it's a third military organization, was formed by Avraham Yair Stern. He was a former Irgun leader, and it was named Lochamei Cherut Yisrael, or Lechi, Fighters for the Freedom of Israel. Now, the primary difference between the Irgun and Lechi was Lechi intended to fight the British in Palestine, regardless of their war against Germany. And listen to what Yair Stern said. He said the following, quote, No difference existed between Hitler and Chamberlain, between Dachau or Buchenwald and sealing the gates of Eretz Yisrael. Now, to be fair, he said this in 1940 when he believed that Hitler wanted to make Germany Judenrein through emigration as opposed to extermination. And in December of 1940, Lechi even contacted Germany with a proposal to aid the German conquest in the Middle East in return for the recognition of a Jewish state open to unlimited immigration. Obviously, when they realized what the Nazis were really up to, he obviously changed his tune. But in 1940, when it wasn't clear what the plan would be, we see how strong Stern felt about fighting the British. Now, what's fascinating is that Yair Stern was not a religious Jew, but he wrote a document entitled Ikar Tichiyah. Okay, and this is also on the handout. It's a little hard to read, but Ikar Tchiyah was the platform of the movement. And the truth is, you and I could probably accept what this document says. I'm reading it from a paper copy that I have. In letter Bet, he writes, he cites, and again, he was not a religious Jew. He said, the homeland is Eretz Yisrael, I believe that the borders of Eretz Yisrael are those that are referenced in the Torah. Lizaracha natati et haaretz hazot minahar Mitzrayim anahar hagadol nahar prat. What does he say? He believes that what's the greater Israel? The borders of Israel are from Nahar Mitzrayim to Nahar Prat, from El Arish to the Euphrates. This is the greater Israel, more than what the Irgun had. And the very last, he has 18 principles. The very last one, Habayit. Binyan Habayit HaShlishi. Kisemel LeGula Shlema. Then he says that what? That as a sign of the Gula Shlema, the final redemption, we will have what? The building of the third Beit HaMikdash. Again, Avram Yair Stern was not a religious Jew. In any case, at this point, there were three groups. Yair Stern believed that statehood would be achieved by force, and the Jewish agency who oversaw the Haggadah believed that it would be achieved through diplomacy. At this point, Lechi numbered in the low hundreds, the Irgun in the high hundreds, and the Haganah in the thousands. Now the Palmach, Plugot Machatz, this called the Smite Force. So they were formed in 1941 as an elite fighting force of the Haganah. So I didn't mention it as a fourth group because it was really an active fighting force connected to the Haganah. And the truth is the British actually encouraged the Palmach so that it can help the British if the Nazis invade Palestine. But after the Nazi defeat in El Alamein in 1942 and the threat to Palestine gone, the Palmach was outlawed. And it went underground to try to help with illegal immigration with the assistance of the Haganah. Now the Lechi fought against the British. They began to rob British banks to get money. And the British tried to eliminate Lechi and they actually killed Avram Yair Stern. They called Lechi the Stern Gang. And he was killed in 1942. The nature of his death was disputed. It has been alleged that he was shot in cold blood unarmed, and the settlement Kochav Yair was named for him. On November 6, 1944, the Lechi assassinated Lord Moyne, the British Prime Minister resident in the Middle East in Cairo. He was the highest ranking British officer in the region. Yitzhak Shamir, leader of the Lechi at that time, claimed later that Moyne was assassinated because of his support for a Middle Eastern federation and anti-Semitic lectures in which Arabs were held to be racially superior to Jews. This assassination outraged Winston Churchill, and he said that he might need to reconsider support for the Jewish state. For 4 months then, Lechi and Irgun members were hunted down. Menachem Begin, leader of the Irgun at that time, went into hiding as Rabbi Sassover. Apparently, once he was asked to be a witness to a ksuva for a wedding, and he was afraid that if he signed his real name, then he would be discovered. And if he signed as his alias, then the ksuva would be invalid, and the couple would not be allowed to live together. So he just didn't show up to the wedding. And later he said he forgot. If you look again, now if you look at the handout, sorry, let me put the handout here. If you look at the handout here, so on the top right, we see is a wanted poster that the British police put out with the reward leading, reward for information leading to the arrest of three Lehi members. The one on the right is Natan Friedman Yellen. The one on the left is Yaakov Levenstein. And the one on in the middle is pretty famous. And in the, it says here, it's hard, if maybe you have a hard copy, if you printed one, it says Yitzchak Yezernitsky. But this Yitzchak Yezernitsky later changed his name to Yitzchak Shamir. So he had the privilege to have his name on a wanted poster by the British police. After World War II, the British renewed the white paper, so the Irgun was back in business, attacking the bridges and new roads, and the Haganah changed its policy. Now, everyone fought together. Perhaps one of the most famous attacks was on July 22nd, 1946. Again, if you look in the source sheet, the bottom right, this is the bombing, the result of the bombing of the King David Hotel. Now, it wasn't just a regular hotel. Half of the hotel was British administrative and military headquarters. And this bombing was payback because the British had raided the Jewish agency to track down Jewish leaders. Now, the Haganah actually approved of the attack. Everyone was together. Haganah, Lehi, and Irgun were all on the same page when it came to the bombing at the King David Hotel. But there is some dispute as to whether the Haganah canceled its approval last minute. But Irgun members, disguised as Arab workmen and hotel waiters, planted a bomb in the basement of the main building in the hotel. The Irgun sent warnings by telephone, but the warnings were ignored, and the hotel was not evacuated. 91 people were killed, including 17 Jews. And the Haganah publicly condemned the attack. But it is not clear whether they did so as not to be hunted down by the British. The difference between Lehi and the Irgun is that Lehi had no qualms about killing individuals, whereas the Irgun scrupulously tried to avoid this. Although they would at times resort to targeted assassination, like when they retaliated to the British hanging of three Irgun members by hanging two British sergeants. In any case, after the King David bombing, the British then ordered a general curfew. And then they told everyone not to patronize Jewish stores. A little BDS, I guess. But finally, the British relented, and they left the matter for the United Nations, which adopted the partition plan in 1947. At that point, once the British said, UN, it's up to you, the Irgun and the Lehi stopped attacking the British. I'm sorry. Once the UN adopted the partition plan, at that point, the Irgun and the Lehi stopped attacking the British. The Irgun and Lehi actually were against the partition plan. But in any case, they coordinated to defend against Arabs before the state was formed. One significant post-partition plan pre-state operation was on April 9th, 1948, in Deir Yassin, when around 120 fighters from the Irgun and Lehi entered the Arab village of Deir Yassin as they tried to relieve the blockade of Jerusalem. The fighting was fierce, and many Palestinian women and children were killed, some during the fierce fighting, and some when hand grenades were thrown into their homes. There were stories of massacres, looting, and rapes, and a caravan of doctors were killed in response a few days later, and the reputation of the Irgun was permanently damaged. This operation was significant because the reports of massacres and rapes, they weren't necessarily true, or they may have been. There might have been, it was not clear what the facts were exactly, and that was disputed, but certainly the Arab media embellished what had happened, and it scared the Arab population, and many fled in fear of their life. They also left because Arab armies told them to leave so that they could kill the Jews. And after they defeat the Jews, the Arabs can come back. It was a great plan, but there was just one problem. They did not defeat the Jews, and the Jews never left. Hence, what they call the refugee crisis. After the creation of the State of Israel, the groups eventually disbanded and folded into the Israel Defense Forces, or the IDF, although not without controversy and some bloodshed. You can read about the Altalena affair in 1948, which involved the debate of how to allocate weapons and whether the Irgun would remain separate from the IDF. And this incident nearly led to a civil war between the Irgun and the IDF, but ultimately, the Irgun agreed to fold itself into the IDF. And what's fascinating about these three pre-Israel military groups is that the leaders of all of these three groups eventually became Prime Minister of Israel. David Ben-Gurion was the leader of the Haganah. Menachem Begin was the leader of the Irgun. And Yitzhak Shamir was the leader of Lehi. Chagai Segel is an Israeli journalist, and he wrote an article in Mekor Rishon, it's an Israeli paper, about 10 years ago, about the religious response to these military groups. Was the religious establishment in favor of these groups? Were they ambivalent or were they against? He argued that although the Irgun and Lehi had many religious fighters, the religious Zionists in general were far more patient and measured. And they were hesitant about a Jewish army, and certainly about guerrilla warfare. Most religious Jews did not want to involve themselves in the war against the British and the Arabs. The Haredim believed that a Jewish kingdom would descend from heaven, and nationalists hoped that it would come through a political process in settling the land. And they were not so comfortable taking up arms against the British. There is a work entitled Sefer HaTzionut HaDatit. This work contains two volumes that discussed religious Zionist work in the last 100 years before 1948, and not one article was dedicated to the underground struggle. And Chagai Segel says the reason is very simple. They were not involved in this. They were more interested in settling the kibbutzim of Tirat Tzvi, Sdei Eliyahu, Ein HaNetziv, Kfar Etzion, and Kfar Darom. The Bnei Akiva youth movement focused more on building the land and not spilling blood over it. And they only supported joining Haganah for defense of the settlements. They also got money from the Jewish agency, which denounced Irgun and Lehi. The religious Zionist yeshivot had some students who sympathized with Lehi and Irgun, but they were only permitted to join the Haganah. Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria, former Rosh Yeshiva of Kfar Roeh, explained the concern that if his students joined Irgun or Lehi, then that would endanger the entire existence of the yeshiva. Most rabbis felt that Dina de Machuta, Dina, the law of the land is the law applied to the British mandate, and the Rabbanut HaRashit stated that any killing of anyone not in the context of defense at that moment, police officer, soldier, or citizen, is considered murder. Still, some younger students joined, and more joined the Irgun rather than the Haganah. Many leaders of the Irgun and Lehi came from religious homes. Yair Stern actually went to Merkoz Harav, but he ended up not being religious. In 1946, when Lehi killed British soldiers as a payback for the arrest and killing of a number of Jews, the Rabbanut HaRashit condemned the attack. We don't find the religious leadership using the model of the Chashmonaim or Rabbi Akiva Bar Kokhba in supporting the Irgun and Lehi, at least openly. The focus was immigration, settlement, and diplomacy for the most part. It should be noted, though, that the moderate stance taken by the religious establishment may have been more based on practical rather than ideological grounds. When Rav Sharya Shuv Cohen, former chief rabbi of Haifa, was studying in Merkoz Harav, the British complained to the Rosh HaYeshiva, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, the son of Rav Avram Yisrael Cohen Cook, that some students are associated with suspects. And Rav Cook told the British that he does not tell students what to decide regarding politics. And Rav Shar Yashiv Cohen, who was a member of Lehi with the blessing of his father, the Nazir, thinks that the Rabbanut needed to take this moderate stance because it had to maintain its ties with the British. And in fact, after 1948, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook was proud to say that David Raziel, the former founder and leader of the Irgun, was actually studied in his yeshiva. Rav Eliezer Melamed is a prominent religious Zionist rabbi alive today. And he asserts that Rav Cook supported the Irgun and the Lehi, even boasting that he agreed to hide underground literature in his home. In sum, all three groups, the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Lehi, were all very important for Jewish statehood in Eretz Yisrael. We need diplomacy for world support. But if we only had diplomacy without active defense, then it is possible that the British would not have been pressured to leave Palestine to the decision of the UN. The debates between these groups from 70, 80 years ago are alive and well today. Debates about restraint and to what extent we should rely on other nations. It seems to me that for the Haredim were opposed, that Haredim were opposed to the military groups because they were against the whole Zionist enterprise to begin with. And the religious Zionist establishment, by and large, were opposed to the Irgun and Lehi, partially for ideological and probably partially for pragmatic reasons. There was a fear of retribution, and the way that they hoped to build up the state was primarily through settlement, immigration, settlement, and diplomacy. But some rabbinic figures must have at least privately approved of what these groups were doing, because there are times that we must don the hands of Esav and do what is necessary. And that is constantly our struggle. Always Hakol Kol Yaakov. Always ensuring that we have the conscience of Yaakov Avinu in determining how to remain moral in an immoral world, while at the same time being prepared to have the Yadayim Yaday Esav, to don the hands of Esav when necessary. Tonight, we celebrate that great successful experiment called the modern state of Israel, Medinat Yisrael. We mourn the loss of lives of those who died trying to create the state and trying to defend the state. And we celebrate that we have a place to return, and a place to return that forces us to ask the tough questions that we haven't asked for 2,000 years because we were visitors in someone else's land. Now, after 2,000 years, we are asking ourselves, when do we don the hands of Esav? And it's so beautiful because it means that we see ourselves not just as a religion of Jews, not just as a family of Jews or as a community of Jews, but now, after 2,000 years, we see ourselves as a nation, as an Am of Jews, as an Am Yisrael. And as we celebrate the 72nd anniversary of Medinat Yisrael, we can proudly proclaim, Am Yisrael Chai. Thank you.